That's why I don't wish even my own mom happy Mother's Day. I'm just kidding. Imagine.
Wow.
I'm going.
Are we going yet? Or
we are now.
Oh, okay. I was like, it'd be a crazy intro. We're just talking about Mother's Day for the first few minutes.
Like we are now.
Like we are now.
Hi, everyone.
Good morning, afternoon, evening.
Nighttime.
Midnight. Driving to somewhere. Good.
Like Trixie and Katya. Hi to everybody on the 110, the 405, the 5. That's what they always say.
Is that what they say?
They're, it's so silly. And I love it when I'm on the 405 and they're like, hi to everyone on the 405.
What's
I'm like,
a, what's
yes.
a road in the UK so we can acknowledge that fan base?
Hi, everyone on the tube. I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
That works. So, what's
hey.
Up? We're back. What are we doing it today, Alexandros?
Part 3 of Alchemized, baby. We know you're sick of this book, but I don't care. We're going to keep talking about it.
Where is it? Oh, it's right there.
There it is. Yeah, we're good.
I was like, wait. There we go.
Uh-oh. Knock over the library.
It's okay. There we go. Okay, we're back.
Woo! If you heard just like, weird wait. Grunts in the mic and you're not watching,
we're back I with apologize. This lovely one, Alchemized by Sun Liu.
Yes. If you've tuned into parts 1 and 2, you should know this part was not planned. That's why we're wearing different stuff now and why we are.
Alexandros is a certified yapper.
I have so much to say about this book. And even in this episode, I'm probably not going to end up saying it all.
That's
but it's my intention that we get through the meat of this. The potatoes will come later, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Just the meat. The meat is the important part. If you're vegetarian, not anymore. The meat is coming right now.
Incognito vibes.
Incognito.
Yes.
Yes. Who came up with that?
I don't know, but it's hilarious.
We're doing a bad job of staying on track already.
I actually used to be a vegetarian for 7 years. Did you know that about me?
I feel like you've mentioned it so many times.
Hey, shut the hell up.
I'm going to be so honest right now. If you're going to read me for being a yapper, I'm going to read you for being like, guys, you know Maddie used to be a vegetarian?
Period.
Yeah.
Anyways.
I don't think I knew that actually, though.
Oh, okay. So
no, I knew that.
Okay, let's go into it.
Okay, so the main goal of this episode, apart from me actually staying on track, is to talk about the most impactful moments. Now, yeah. I really wanted to do like a play by play. However,
when a book time is 1,000 pages, a play by play is a little difficult.
Time is linear. We're running out. And there are just more important things to talk about than the plot points, I think.
So we're going to
start off still in part 2, which is the flashbacks, but just the overall progression of the enemies to lovers dynamic. And then we'll get to part 3, the parts that you really wanted to talk about and everything like that. So first and foremost, let's talk about the Sunstone Amulet being, you know, the stone of the heavens and what the implications are from like the history of the world. Versus now in the overarching themes of the story.
Yes.
Look at how intellectual that sounded.
That
guys.
Sounded really, really smart.
And I didn't even used to be a vegetarian for 7 years.
Yeah, you got that extra iron that I lost. My brain
there it is. Yeah.
Is a little behind you. Maybe that's why you have a better memory than I do.
I have a horrible memory.
No, you don't. You always remember everything.
This is a hyperfixation. It's not memory. There's a complete difference right there.
Okay, that's, I guess, actually, I'll give you that.
If you ask me what we talked about the last 2 episodes... No idea.
Yeah, I honestly
absolutely no idea.
You.
I could remember every aspect of this book, but not what I said about this book.
Period.
Yeah.
That's valid.
But we find out that what was in her amulet was this thing called the Stone of the Heavens, which is, in alchemical terms, a philosopher's stone. Don't Harry Potter this. It's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
But it's made up
That's
of
just a reference in the world.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's a thing in all in like other things that are alchemy.
Yeah.
Oh, in this world. Oh, not this world.
Like in
our
life.
World. In life.
Yeah. That's not specifically.
Yes.
Key content.
Mm-hmm. But it is made up of the souls of a town that the first necromancer who fought Orion Holdfast, the first
patriarch
principate of Palladia. What he created when they fought, he. Sucked all the souls of the town, essentially, and used them in an alchemical experiment to force them into this that granted him power, immortality, all these other types of things. And in their fight, you know, the stone rebelled against him because it's thousands of souls that are still very mad.
Crazy, by the way.
And angry. Like, imagine, like, you're just stuck for all eternity in there.
It's giving
all
Sophia people, the First.
Pretty much, except...
No, Elena. Wasn't Elena
was trapped in there, but Sophia the First is the one who
with
had
the amulet.
She didn't
That's a niche reference, everybody.
Guys, that was really...
That was a niche reference.
On point for the
But that's true. Except it was just one... Yeah, period.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
And so they all rebel against this first necromancer and destroy him in like a huge, massive, bright light of explosion, which when we find out later that Morrow has no eyes, there's a quote that Farron says about it, it's like they were burned out because eyes aren't something that you can alchemically heal.
Yep.
They have to be like slowly patched back together. And if they're gone, they're gone. That's not something that can be repaired.
Cut back to previously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He fixed her eyes and it was like,
yeah,
a crazy
such
thing.
An intense thing.
Yeah.
But that's the foreshadowing of who Morrow is right there. Mm-hmm. And honestly, guys, the second reread, I know I've said this so many times in the last couple episodes, everything just comes together so much more beautifully than it even does the first time.
It's
so read it twice.
It's like a big puzzle.
Mm-hmm. And then when you're putting it, you're like,
Leonardo DiCaprio.
It's like Tony Stark in front of the
screen. Yeah. Totally.
Piecing it together. So Helena is told this story by Ilva and basically freaks out because the modern story is that Sol, the god of the sun god, gave Orion the stone of the heavens to vanquish the necromancer and that it is divinely blessed that they are meant to rule this land and everything.
Yes.
When she finds out that this isn't true and that the true story is just something that they like pushed under the rug just to ensure that like there would be stability.
Typical.
It reinforces what she's said in other times where the winners always get to decide the story they want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over again, it's not necessarily a battle of good versus evil. It's just two sides against each other. Now, objectively, there are bad sides.
There's
sometimes.
A worse side.
Yeah. The necromancers are the bad side in this one.
But the good guys aren't necessarily purely good. Mm-hmm.
But this need to push this narrative over and over again, instead of embracing new ideas and allowing your citizens to have context for things so they can understand their world better, it ends up narrowing their perspective so greatly that they have no chance at winning because they're not looking into any, once again, to what I've said, the deeper causes and everything. They're just addressing symptoms. So nobody knows where Morrow comes from or why he's there. There's just always an evil necromancer that has to be dealt with.
Yeah.
Why is he here? What is he actually after? His morals aren't clear. He's granting immortality, but nobody knows why. What? And if they actually looked into these issues, they could come to some answers as opposed to just, oh, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Soul divinely judges it so. It's the most infuriating thing.
Yeah. I get that.
Yeah. What was your idea to the reveal about what the stone of the heavens, well, not the sword of the heavens, the stone of the heavens?
What was my idea?
What was like your first thoughts when like they reveal what the history of it is?
I think once again, my thoughts for this was that I just was so appreciative of how she was able to take something that we knew. I think I was thinking about it more from like a writing sense of how she took something that we based in a world that we knew and completely rewrote it.
Yeah.
I think that is just incredible. Gotcha. And like the idea that you're talking about with the like their whole downfall. Palladia, right? Their whole downfall is the fact that they are constantly hiding and they're so opposed to actually figuring everything out is so, I think, compelling because it's so actually realistic. I feel like in today's society, that's so relatable.
Yeah.
Because what do we actually know about what's going on? Kind of nothing, you know? And so I just think it's like, yeah, sounds about right.
That's
like
about
what
right.
I said
it
earlier.
Checks out. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is realistic because for all of history, these people who are the winners or the good guys, they keep hiding things from everybody. So no one actually knows what the hell is going on. Mm-hmm. I just think it's so interesting. Yeah.
And then they can't even tell Luke about it because his whole claim to this rebellion is that, you know, it's divinely chosen.
And Luke is so blinded by this is what's good. This is what's right.
But what's crazy is that with Luke's character, he would probably still accept that and keep pushing forward for what should be, even knowing that there's no divine answer that's coming to save him right
now.
But he keeps holding out hope and doubting himself as a result.
Oh. Damn.
Ooh.
I just think that the ideas of this book, like that's so like huge and meta and big and so much bigger than just like something that was a silly, it's not silly, but to outside people, silly fan fiction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, that's the Dramani fan fiction that got made into a book.
Exactly.
Like,
no,
it's so much more.
It's actually so smart and such, honestly, an interesting worldview based off, because
it is,
you know, like.
Do you think we at the Smut Couch would be talking about it if it wasn't profound?
Exactly. I think one of the last times I said, I feel like I almost want this to be considered like a modern day classic, you know, because it is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And it is so like, kind of like, I know that this is Harry Potter fan fiction, but also it was kind of Handmaid's Tale adjacent. How Handmaid's Tale adjacent is kind of a commentary. Now, okay, let me center my thoughts.
Reset.
Let me center my thoughts. So much of what is happening, this is going to get kind of, deep and like a lot. So much of what's happening in the world right now, a lot of times people are referencing it back to The Handmaid's Tale. You know what I mean? Because like, yikes, with the whole travel thing, like there's that episode, I read the book, but there's an episode of the TV show with like, the traveling is spooky between like partners and their kids and stuff like that. And I think that this should be, though it takes ideas from Handmaid's Tale. This is kind of what is happening in like a really intense way. This isn't actually happening, but I just want people to read this and realize how smart it is. And also I think the more you read stuff like this, the more you kind of get wise of what's going on around you.
You can see the patterns. Yeah.
Yeah.
Life imitates
art.
That was
kind of tangential, but you know what I'm trying to say.
No, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Don't worry. I'm with it.
Thank you. I just want this to be known. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. Don't go.
This is going to take 30 seconds.
I've been yapping nonstop. This is your time.
I just want this to be respected in ways that stuff like The Handmaid's Tale is.
Yes. I hate putting the label
exactly
on some of these books that's just like, oh, that's the one that's
exactly.
Like, there's so much more to it.
This is of such a high caliber. Yeah. And I wish that it was respected as such.
Mm-hmm.
Put some respect on her motherfucking check. That's all.
Period.
Now go on.
All right. The next big thing that I wanted to talk about is how long the flashbacks are. Speaking of how long things are taken and everything. The flashbacks are so... I feel like it's intentional. So it's not... It's going to feel like this is a critique, but it's not, because it serves its purpose in the sense that the flashbacks take way too long. There's so much detail and stuff going into them that even like on my read of it, I was like, dang, we're still in here. But it really fleshes out these characters in a sense that with Helena and Farron, with how their dynamic grows and naturally progresses to the point where they are together, of them being so codependent. And these flashbacks follow such a long period of time that you forget what the story is. You genuinely are reading this thinking this is the main story. The first part of this book is kind of put into the background.
You forget, like
as you
said,
fall
last
in love
time,
with the main plot.
You forget about it.
Yeah.
Completely forget
And that's
about
so
it.
Intentional, I feel at
yeah,
least.
Yeah, I think so too.
Because by the end of it, you know, you're sitting there and you're going, she's going to make it out. Everything's going to work on out for them, because it's so desperate of a gamble, every move that they make in that last instant, that the knife just twists so painfully.
Yeah.
But anyways, as Farron and Helena have their little weekly meetings, and his back is all fixed now for the most part. He has the array back there, and he's got the stone in his chest.
Yeah.
Pumping out life to him. But
coolest thing ever, by the way.
So cool. Such a cool thing.
Yeah.
Just carve stuff into your back. Don't do that. Don't do that, guys.
No.
Don't. No need to do that. Sorry.
It's okay.
I just remember that this is to people who don't know me, my sarcasm.
And also the way... the way the tension builds is so everything to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way she I feel like the closest to a true enemies to lovers we'll ever really get.
Yeah, because they do greatly dislike each other.
Yes.
She cannot trust him. Farron from the get-go is thinking that Helena is just with the program, that he's going to be used and then discarded, but he'll at least make what do they call them? The undying suffer and everything. And so there's never an instant of trust between them, if that makes sense, until Helena starts to find out the root reasonings behind things and why he's doing what he's doing. The why behind the symptoms, essentially.
And the why is what makes her realize that he's actually just a person trying to get through and doing what he has to do.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Just doubling down on all these themes. It's getting to the point where it's like someone who's really just bashing this into our heads.
Mm-hmm.
But some people just don't get it, you know?
Well, I mean, you bringing up that idea at the beginning, like the first episode we talked about this.
Yeah.
because you've read this twice. I have not.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, oh, wow. It's not bashing you over the head in a negative way.
I don't mean a negative.
Yeah, I
but
know.
It's like when you're like putting it all together, connected.
Exactly. Like we said earlier, the puzzle. It's so effective, I think.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So good. Mm-hmm. And from the moment where she knows that she can use his feelings against him, mm-hmm. and that he does feel things because the array is forcing it, and she jumps at that chance, mm-hmm. and he hates her as he loves her after their first intimate moment together. Mm-hmm. It's just such a, because he was creating that barrier because he knows he can't resist his urges that are in his back because he's so driven and focused on what he focuses on.
Yeah.
He literally has no control over himself. Mm-hmm. So he forces himself, but
biting my finger.
So he forced himself to not, so that he wouldn't succumb to those wants that he had.
Like once human he did, feelings.
Yeah, there would be no backing off from him. He can't divert his attention once he's given it.
Yeah.
And he feels like he's going to be enslaved by a new master, essentially, which he is. And so he's like, well, that's that, I guess. Go ahead and tell Crowther whatever you want. And this is the first humane moment that we get from Crowther when she goes back.
Yeah.
Because this is the point where she's healed his hand from one of Luke's outbursts or something like that. Because do you remember he had it strapped up to his chest and everything? And she just found a way to heal it while she was doing that. And he's finally seeing her as more than just the tool that he's been using her as. Mm-hmm. And Crowther's character is interesting because I never felt like he was an awful person, but he was most certainly not a good person.
Yeah.
He was.
I think he's a product of what he's living through.
Yeah.
Truly, which is the case for most of these people.
For those of you who don't remember, his village was destroyed by a necromancer when he was a child, and he came to Palladia as a pyromancer with the sole goal of like ensuring that necromancy would never win. Mm-hmm. And he'll use any tools he has at his disposal to ensure that.
Yeah.
He's one of the only reasons the Eternal Flame has a shot, because he's willing to do what's necessary, even if it's from the shadows. But this is the one moment when she comes back after sealing the deal, for lack of a better word. And he is genuinely concerned about her, saying, "You are the most valuable asset the Eternal Flame has."
Period. And she did not fight. Are we fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm pissed. Hey, I'm pissed. I'm pissed.
And the way that he speaks to her and helps her recover and everything in the best way that he can, mm-hmm. while still keeping that distance so he can use her as he needs to.
Right.
It's so clear that he's just used to using people like this. So when Ivy's sister dies, Sophia, he has a chance to keep Ivy in the loop and use her, but instead he lashes out at Ivy for being at fault. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, if you hadn't been always bragging to your sister, we could still keep her alive. And that also ends up leading to Ivy betraying them all and everything. But it's Crowther, just be a normal person, dude. Just be a human person.
No one in this instance has the shot of being a normal person.
Yeah.
They're in too extreme times. They're all struggling too much that
Soren's the only one who had a shot, I think.
Yeah. Soren. Yeah. It's just, it's too hard. They're all crumbling underneath it.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Yeah. Sounds familiar.
When there's one moment where Farron and Helena's relationship finally shifts, and it's right after they save Luke, and she uses necromancy on Soren for the first time in such an epic scene and everything. We talked about it a little bit last time.
Yeah.
But that's also thematically, if we're going to believe that good versus evil is a thing, that they can't use necromancy because that's the test that the gods have sent down.
Yeah.
That's the exact moment also where they lose the war, essentially, when Helena uses necromancy because they've lost Luke, but they don't know it yet. That's mm-hmm. no longer Luke with them.
Yeah.
And that's also when around the time, shortly afterwards, after she uses the necromancy, she goes over to Farron. Farron takes her in Amaris, and they kind of get together again, smoochy smoochy, and it's good this time for both of them. And then he realizes that she does have feelings for him. She's not just looking for someone to make the pain go away.
She
chooses him. Mm-hmm. He locks in, and he's fully devoted to her from that point on.
I have butterflies again.
She is officially his, you're mine, et cetera, gonna take care of you, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
All those things. That is the clear shift in that relationship, as well as the shift in what's going to be happening with the war. The moment she allows herself to care for somebody, and uses that necromancy, you can pick it either lane, is the moment that they lost that war.
Work.
In the overarching thing. Now, I know you can say those are two completely unrelated things, but if we're going in the metaphysical world for it,
I mean,
she uses necromancy and Luke is possessed, well, and they can't do anything.
Yeah. I think it's her finally kind of letting loose in a way. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, it's her finally choosing new paths for herself. You know, her letting, what am I trying to say? Like letting her her urges and her, like
her wants,
her wants win. It's her the, stepping into her power, I think, in both ways.
The clearest example of it, I think, is what Farron says in when he goes, you get to have this. You get to enjoy this part. You deserve to enjoy things in general. I know what they're talking about in specific.
But
it's more of a, she is so afraid to feel anything good because she's so afraid of it being taken away, which hurts even more when it is taken away.
I know.
Sorry.
And I think that that's also such a relatable thing. Like that's some, that's a fear of so many people is like, I don't want to let myself have things because I don't think I deserve it, or because the pain of losing is even worse than the thought of never having at all, which I think that's the thing that people think when that's actually not true, you know? But I think that's such a relatable part of Helena's character, but also Farron, he's the same way, you know? His whole thing is, I can't lose somebody and lose them. Yes.
It happened to my mother. It happened to all the servants who like helped raise me.
And he also sees himself as this monster that's on the wrong side.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like, I don't deserve to live. He never sees a frame. He never sees a world where he's in the picture frame, essentially, at the end of this. No matter what, he has to die. When they find out that the obsidian kills the undying and destroys some piece of Morrow, he's going, well, that just doubles down on the thought that I have to die if we're going to be beating Morrow.
Yeah.
That's the only way that any of this works.
Do you know what this makes me think of? You know, and like when you're reading this book, especially for like the first time, or if the first time if you read it was Manacled or whatever, but you're like thinking like there's no way that they can actually get out of this. It's like Doctor Strange in Endgame. He's like the one, this, or the Infinity War. He's like, this is the one way. You're reading this and it's the bleakest you'll ever feel reading anything ever. There is no way anybody is going to come out of this alive at all. And that's what makes the ending so amazing, because they
three
do.
Three of them make it out alive. I know.
But like our main protagonists do. And it's almost
because
unbelievable.
Because they get to have this.
Yes.
They get to be happy.
And it's the first time they both are
fight
like,
hard enough for it. Yeah. Because the entire time, they're not really fighting for their futures.
No.
I guess at the main point, they're fighting for other people to be happy. Helena's always fighting for Luke, for, you know, for Soren, for Lila.
For them to get
to have a future together. Yeah. And she's resigned herself to never getting that. One, because of, you know, any of the crimes she's committed during the war. Mm-hmm. And two, because she sells herself to Farron and thinks, I'm never going to get to be with them. So I'm fighting for them. And Farron is fighting for his mother. He's fighting to ensure that her memory gets to not, she doesn't die for nothing. And that to avenge her. And that the Eternal Flame can maybe rise on up and people won't have to deal with Morrow anymore. In both those instances, they're not really succeeding in their fights because they're not fighting for themselves. Mm-hmm. It's that philosophy that, you know, when a plane's crashing, you got to put your mask over, your oxygen
yourself
mask
first.
On yourself first before you help anyone else. Yeah. The sinking ship, put on your life vest first, and then help other people.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that you want something.
Yeah.
Not that you want it for someone else.
Yeah.
Because you can only advocate, you're the most valuable advocate for yourself, if that makes sense.
I think they also both think that the only way for them to, for their side, the good to win, is for them to suffer as badly as possible. Mm-hmm. So when it's finally understood between the both of them that, wait, we can both be happy and we can kind of be happy together, the way that opens up the world so much more, and it kind of shows, like, truly, this is going to be so cheesy.
Yeah.
Truly, all we have is love, and truly, all we have is connection.
All you need
no,
is
it's
love.
Period. And I literally, I tried so hard not to put on a voice when I said that. Like, oh, we really just, all we need is love, you guys. But it's true. Them finally.
Look how giddy we are talking about how this depressing book is. We're like, you feel so happy, guys. Read it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also telling on how amazing of a writing it is when you do, you shut the book and you're like, first of all, I'm heartbroken, but also I feel inspired and I feel like uplifted.
There's
almost
a hole in my chest and I'm so on.
Maybe that's my Lexapro, though.
Oh, yeah. You're on. I forgot that you're on medication now. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you seem so happy
lately.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, maybe that's it too. But I just think, like, truly love is what wins. And that's what the main, all of our stories that we love, that is the main theme. But in a book so bleak and heartbreaking, you think that it's not going to, but it does. Yeah, and I think that's the magic of it.
It tricks you. Senlin Yu does a great job tricking you into feeling things when it starts off letting you know you should have no hope. There's no shot at any of this being good. Everyone in this story is dead already. Why are you feeling things for them now?
Yeah, and I think people don't want to read this book because it's too dark. And I think it is kind of
skip chapters 18 and 19, then you're good.
But I think it is kind of the thing of, like, the sadness is what makes you, the happy come through so much more. Like, you know, people looking back on their lives will say, like, I'm happy that I had the sad times and the happy times. That's what being a human is. And it makes you, the sad times make you appreciate the happy times.
It's just, we read a lot of things on, not just this, just for this podcast, but in general.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you like reading just for the sake of, like, getting a good little giggle in here and there and doesn't really make you feel much, that's okay here and there.
Totally.
I would strongly encourage, did I say this the first episode though, that whether it's this story or not, that you broaden your horizons in the sense that read something that you're not sure if you'll enjoy here and there. Read something that.
It's kind of what I talked about on my. Solo
for your
episode.
Reading slumps, yeah?
Yeah. Diversify.
That you can only, there's not really a downside to reading things that you don't think you'll like, apart from, like, a little bit of time.
Even if you don't like it, then you have more of an understanding of what you do like.
Exactly. So there's nothing, new experiences in and of themselves, there's nothing negative about that.
I agree.
This story, while there are things that are very valid to not enjoy about it, there are still other things out there that are not in your usual Rolodex of things that you would like to read, that you could really experience something new, whether it's new ideas for your life that you can reflect on, a catharsis of emotions that you're not used to feeling. And even if you don't want to feel those things, sometimes it's good to visit them every now and then.
Yeah. And I think also just excellent writing.
Yeah. Good writing.
I actually saw a TikTok this week. I wish I remembered by who, but she was saying, like, she does book reports on her books to try to help her with, like, her literacy level and also just to help her remember things.
The literacy crisis is real, guys.
The literacy crisis is real. But this is a perfect book to do it because, as you've been pointing out, all of the foreshadowing and the overarching ideas, it is so smart that this is a perfect book to do.
I hesitate to call anything a perfect story because I was about to say that.
Well, I was going to say it's a perfect thing to do that for, but yes.
I was going to say, like, unrelated to what you said perfect just now. Yeah. That was my next thing that I was going to say. I hesitate to call anything a perfect story because I think in art, nothing can be perfect.
Totally. There's,
but when I was saying I literally can't find anything to criticize about it, apart from the rings that are matching. That's the only part where I'm like,
I think the ending of Morrow is a little fucked up, to be honest.
The what?
I think the way Morrow goes down is a little cheesy and I didn't like it. To be so for real, that's the part of this book I didn't like.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that when we get to the third part. Because right now, we're pretty much at the end of what their relationship is, what they've acknowledged.
Yeah.
And when everything falls apart, when it's revealed that Luke is being possessed by Morrow, that Morrow was the first necromancer who's just been finding ways to stay alive this whole time.
Yeah.
And he found the loophole to the Philosopher's Stone freaking out at him, essentially, the Stone of the Heavens, by redirecting the hate of the souls into the Undying while keeping the majority of the power. That's why he cuts the Shard of the Bone out, puts it in you, takes it out, regrows the bone, but keeps the Shard there. So the hatred and the energy, which is still a substantial amount, is contained within you while he gets the power with no strings attached.
Yeah, crazy.
That's also why the Undying start to kind of lose their minds here and there, because they kind of start having the voices start to overpower their mental state.
Yeah.
Which is, once again, something just as a bit of a throwaway line in part one. Farron only gets away with it mostly because it's not that the servant souls were willing. It's that the servant souls don't wish harm upon Farron, if that makes sense. It's a very, because that's what was used for his transformation.
Right.
They sacrificed his servants for him and they helped raise him. I don't think they hated Farron. They weren't just random people grabbed and used. So their hate, while not really being directed at Farron, is kind of there. So it's not great. So when he reanimates all the souls, there's some ambiguity about if he used pieces of their souls for the servants' corpses reanimations, mm-hmm. and that's what alleviated it, or if it's genuinely because while they weren't willing, they weren't unwilling if it meant helping Farron, if that makes sense. I don't know how in depth. I got to really read it to make sure that I'm not doing a crazy wild take about that.
No, I don't think that's crazy or wild at all.
Because even Farron says they act the way they used to, so it could be that I put a piece of their souls back in them, but I think it's mostly because that's how I want them to act.
That makes sense.
So two things can be true or two things can be not true at all.
Hey, everything's up to interpretation. Art's up to
anyways, so tragedy strikes. Helena figures out what's going on with Luke because Elaine Boyle, worthless healer that she is, hate her so much. She is everything wrong with Vivimancers because they're always thinking so that they're so high and mighty and they don't need to know the whys behind anything because they can feel it. Okay. I can feel that something's hurting. I'm going to fix it. But what
just
was
showing
hurting?
Showing up the outside and not fixing anything on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Except like they are fixing what's on the inside, but they don't know what was causing it or anything like that. They don't have an understanding of what they're doing. They have instinct and talent, but no understanding. And you need them together, and that's what makes Helena such a valuable asset across the board.
She's everything to me.
Mm-hmm. Elaine constantly just dealing with the screaming and the agony by just prescribing morphine, not knowing that it's letting Morrow fully take over the body.
It sucks.
That last scene where Sebastian gets killed, all that stuff, agony in my heart.
It's brutal.
Luke finally takes over again. Mm-hmm. He finally regains control of his body, tells Helena, get Sebastian up. They're going to be suspicious mm-hmm. if it's just me leaving. Fully cementing even further that Luke would have done what was necessary to win, mm-hmm. I think, while still being the good guy.
Yeah.
If he, and I know I drove this point really home in the last episodes that we did, if he had actually taken charge as he could have, mm-hmm. instead of just being as non-confrontational as he was.
Being a yes
man. And just kind of not wanting to upset anything because, oh, this is what I have to do. It's what you choose to do that matters, not what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose to do nothing.
Yeah.
And let them all lose. And in the last moments, he's able to gain control, save Helena.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is, and he dies looking at the sunset, asking Lila to not find out that it wasn't him when they first got together.
Ugh.
That, bro, I missed that the first time I read it.
Yeah, I
wasn't,
caught that. I was like, ugh.
And that like really hurt so badly.
Mm-hmm. It sucks. You know,
that she thought he was me. And not, obviously you don't tell Lila.
No.
You know, obviously you can't do that. But anyway, Luke's dead.
What a burden.
Sebastian dies. They die in an alley looking at the sun up in the clouds and everything. Devastating.
It's so sad.
And then this is once again where things start to go wrong for Helena and Farron, because Farron stops fighting to live for himself and starts fighting just to make sure Helena can survive. That's when he knocks her out, takes her back, and then the whole scheme happens. They blow up the lab.
Oh, I thought that part was really cool.
I wanted more from that scene in the sense that, like, I really wanted her to have just an army of necrothralls.
Oh, that'd be
just going to town. That's what I wanted, because not to compare it to Manacled, I know, but this is the coolest scene in Manacled with Dementors can burn,
really,
you know, and you do that whole thing.
Yeah.
I really thought we were going to get her running away and then the Undying were going to get a taste of their own medicine about how horrifying necrothralls are, with her just reanimating like a good little small army.
Literally hard home. In Game of Thrones, literally, with the Night King, like, doom.
Yeah, and Jon Snow's
like, fuck that.
Dude. Or,
that is the coolest scene literally in the history of
everything
ever. I'm
not disappointed with what we got.
No, but I get it.
I'm just greedy. I want more.
That's what I thought we were going to get to. Mm-hmm. I was in the same thing. And I think probably it's just Manacled in the back of my head, mm-hmm. you know?
So that's my only point that I was like, but that's not even a critique. That's just something I wanted. I wanted to read that.
Yeah, that's valid.
And she's shoved in, you know, the stasis pod afterwards.
Oof.
Awake. What was the warden's name again? Oh my gosh. It's been a week since
warden.
We did.
Warden.
You know the warden.
Shit.
No. I have all my notes right here. Hold on. I'm scrolling down.
The names.
You talk about something else while I scroll.
Well, they really have a beautiful love story now, don't they? mm-hmm. Could you
Mandel.
Imagine?
Mandel. Yes.
Good job. Like Howie Mandel, but mm-hmm. not. So she's in the Stacy.
Yeah, thing. This was so funny though when Mandel's like, were you worried I'd find you or something like that? Mm-hmm. And Helena's like, I haven't even thought about you since I tortured you, girl. Oh my gosh, get a life. Like, do you ever think about that when somebody like says something to you, like when they bring up something that you genuinely haven't thought of? You're like, have you really been thinking about that this whole time?
That kind of makes me feel so comfortable.
I know, right?
Like, hey, I actually haven't given you a second thought.
Oh my gosh, what was your name again? Actually,
I love a what period. Was your name again, actually, that's so.
What good. Are the? Sorry, this is unrelated to anything, but do you know like some really good burns just to like make people like lose aura when they're fighting with you? Like, for example. Not like that, but like just rage baiting comments, I guess, not to lose aura, just rage baiting comments. It's the, do you ever wish you were athletic? Or like, what sport would you play if you were athletic? Something like that. Mm. Oh, you have a sleeper build. You say that to a guy who's very clearly like physically.
A fit. Sleeper build?
Yeah.
hilarious. You're
like actually really muscular. You wouldn't notice that or something like that.
Ouch.
One that I saw on TikTok that I thought was hilarious is when you're arguing with someone, hit them with the. Sit up straight when you're talking to me.
I saw that too.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Stand up straight when you're talking to me.
I'm going to use that. I'm putting that in my back pocket.
And the second that they like readjust, you know you've
like,
won.
I won.
You win that one.
Period. That's
like,
hilarious.
Can you speak clearly? Stuff like that.
I love it.
Solomon, has anyone ever hit you with one of those? With a, what sport would you play if you were athletic?
No, because I'm athletic.
See, that's the rage bait. That's the rage bait, Solomon.
Oh.
So you've got a child. Surely they've rage baited you before.
That's hilarious. I'm excited to get to later. Mm-hmm. I have quotes that I'm excited to share.
Okay. Let's move on to part three now.
Okay.
We're officially here. What are your most impactful moments from part three, I guess?
I just think like by part, my mind immediately goes to them being able to live a life.
Yes.
You know, I think, like I said earlier, it seems so impossible for them. Because they go and they live with Lila, right? That's her name in this?
Lila, yes.
Lila. They go on an island. They go away to an island.
That whole journey. Anything from before they actually managed to get away, though? Or is this?
I remember the way. Can you remind me what happens tomorrow at the end?
So. That's after they've run away, but Morrow is, you know, he's on life support on his corpse chair, essentially.
Yeah.
He can't really move or do anything.
How's he defeated? I forget.
He's defeated. He's pretty much off-screened. Lila goes on back.
Pissed me off.
And kills him. But I think that's part of the point of it. Yeah. So I'll defend this in the sense that that's what mattered. This great necromancer that's been alive for several hundred years.
Yeah.
And, fought for immortality and is the, you know, character antagonist
totally.
Type thing. He doesn't matter. Everything
True.
That he's doing, he's just
that.
An obstacle that our two main characters never needed to deal with because all this fighting for immortality power, it doesn't really matter in the sense that you have what you want. You have each other. You have your child now. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be a part of this great epic scale of good and evil, quote
right.
unquote.
You can go live a quiet life. Alexandra.
Everything's fine.
He knocked over a lamp for those listening, and now it's not on. Okay, there it is. Oh my God. Okay,
it's fine.
Go.
Yeah, we're good.
That was crazy.
Anyways. Good and evil. Yeah. What does it matter, guy? Just love, man.
I get what
Peace
you mean,
and love.
Though. I get what you mean. I think I kind of felt like, it flickered again. I think I kind of was like, oh yeah, okay. I remember that feeling not satisfying to me, but that makes sense what you're saying.
The prosecution rests, Your Honor.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, I guess, okay. That would suck the way she remembers everything. How disorienting, first of all.
Yeah, everything's out of order and everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, when she first gets all her memory back, she associates Farron with everything that she remembers that's good about him. But it doesn't check in with her most recent memories about him. It's like two separate things being put together.
Two separate people. And she's trying to like...
She doesn't know which one is real.
Mm-hmm. It's like Hunger Games, Catching Fire.
PETA?
Real or not
real. I just started rereading Hunger Games. That's
oh,
crazy
yeah.
that you said that.
Oh, hell yeah. It's like the real or not real thing. You know, she's so traumatized.
Yeah.
Rightfully, and he
Rightfully
is too.
So,
they
yeah.
both are.
They're both just not
like,
happy.
And so is Lila.
I think Farron has a great line where Farron goes like, after all, every single unimaginable horror that I've ever thought of hasn't quite happened to you yet. Yeah, let's try something else right now. Sure, he's so funny.
The way his like sarcasm is hysterical, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just think, damn, good for them for surviving that.
Yeah. Ugh. When she's like, that would mean he hadn't come because she was stuck there for like almost 2 years. And he goes, of course I looked for you.
Oh, yeah. He's so mad everywhere. At himself.
I looked everywhere except the one place that matters.
It's just
so cool. The main way that they're able to escape finally from the clutches of Mauro, because he can't go anywhere without his phylactery. And even if he has it,
yeah.
That gives them a month before the bone like decomposes. I can't remember what the specifics were.
Yeah.
And even in my reread, I tried to focus on the parts that were going to explain that. I never got an answer that I can confidently explain here.
Hey, and you know what? I have to say I'm impressed with the way you've confidently explained a lot of this.
Yeah, but it made sense. He can't go too far without the core bone that he needs, the phylactery.
Yeah.
Because he only has a fragment. But once he got it, I was like, I thought that was the whole point. Now you can go, but it only bought them a month.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm assuming it's because the bone will like degenerate or whatever.
Right.
It has to be connected to
loses power, loses battery. Battery
whatever
drains.
It is, yeah. Ugh. Rechargeable.
Mm-hmm.
So Helena figures out how to do an animancy array, essentially, with the cage that was in the house that his mother was trapped in.
Yeah.
And figures out how to write it on down and to recreate the full process that creates an undying. But this time you would get a willing participant to give up their soul,
mm-hmm.
and put it in him just to rebind that soul to the body.
Yeah.
Because once everything else is let go, so he's unbound from Mauro, the soul's going to be too fragile. That's kind of what ended up happening to Luke, but his
right.
body was also decayed. He had the wrong organs in him.
Organs were black.
Well, yeah, because those were Mauro's organs, remember?
Scary.
Yeah, they just swapped his organs, yeah.
I think one of the images that sticks with me the most is him on the table with the black
organs. Yeah, yeah. And you're sitting there being like, what did they do to his organs?
They're not his.
Those aren't his, man.
They're not his.
Oh, my God. That's why they were always keeping him alive. They're harvesting him for organs, the bones that are in Mauro afterwards. Yeah.
Nasty.
Oh, my God. Nasty. That's so cool.
It's so
cool. I think that's one of the other things that I really like about something. I was thinking about this on the drive to the studio today, that their writing style it doesn't shy away from anything graphic, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. The graphic is there, and it creates a reaction intentionally.
Yeah.
But it's not gratuitous.
Yeah, I agree.
It's very just the right amount, you know,
mm-hmm.
Goldilocks levels of
I totally agree. Yeah, it's perfect.
Because there are things that are intentionally graphic. When you think of shows like The Boys or movies like Deadpool or something like that, where like the gore is like, it's meant to just be like so excessive that, you know, it kind of makes you go,
yeah.
Oh yeah, that guy's balls got ripped off because dot, 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 ha, ha.
Yeah.
But that's, you don't get like a, oh my God, like
that's what
reaction.
Makes me so curious since this has the movie deal. What the hell are we going to rate this thing? Like in a realistic world, they'd have to rate it PG-13 because that's how they get the audience that they're going to want. But there's no way you could make this that's not rated R. You know what I mean? But realistically, it's going to be PG-13.
We don't know that.
I do know that. All of these types of books are always put PG-13. I swear to God, there's no way it wouldn't be. They need the teenagers to come in.
Teenagers can come in. It's fine. It's going to go to streaming. The teenagers are going to watch it. Don't worry.
I know, but to go in to have the theatrical release, it's going to. I promise you it'll be PG-13.
Interesting.
Yep. I'm a cinephile. I know these things.
Mark her words, guys.
Mark my words. So that's what kind of sucks about it, is that it won't be as...
If it's animated, they might be able to get away with it.
It's not. I know.
How do you make this PG-13? How do you make it PG-13? Chapters 18 and 19, how do you make it PG-13?
Rewrite the hell out of it. I'm scared, you guys.
And it's not going to be the story.
That's what I'm saying. I'm scared. I'm not condoning it.
All right, let's get to parental reconciliation right here.
Yeah.
Farron and his dad, Atreus, have a quick little heart-to-heart after Atreus tortures Helena a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, father of the bride's going to do that every now and then. Or father of the groom.
Father-in-law.
Yeah, yeah. Atreus and Farron are such paralleled characters in their arcs, which fathers and sons in stories usually are.
Foils.
The way foils too, yeah. No, foils is when they complement each other. Parallels is when they're the same, right?
Right.
Is that it? Maybe foils is the same thing. I don't know. My
I'm
last English class was about 10 years ago. So.
Mine was longer than that. That's why we need to be doing book reports,
Mrs. Klasna, if you're seeing this, I'm so sorry. Don't judge me.
That's hilarious. No, I think we're making our English teachers proud. Yeah. Look at us.
Look at that. Yeah. Do you ever read you out that you're, like, your English teacher was probably reading books like this?
What, yeah, I had a really,
like, the same English teachers?
Really small story. I had a really psycho English teacher when I was in high school, my sophomore year, who, like, he was crazy. I'm not going to say his name. He was really crazy. He was, like, young hipster guy. I always listened to Bon Iver when we were walking in. But on one of his rules on our syllabus was, do not do a high 10 in my classroom. Like, you could do high fives, but not high 10s. He hated them. Two athletic kids, did a high 10. They were sitting right next to me. We had just finished tests. He picked up both of their tests, ripped them out in half, and threw them in the trash. I said, do not do a high 10 in my classroom.
I got to know what that trauma
is. Isn't that weird?
Imagine, like, when he was young, he did a high 10 with his father, and his father got, like, sliced in half by, like, a train or something like that.
At the end of that class, he goes, pick them up and tape them back together. And then they turned him in and it was fine.
Oh, okay.
But one time he threw a picture frame. It was crazy. Anyways, I just had to tell you that because it was so psycho.
For our international friends, the American education system.
You guys, it was the weirdest thing in the world. All of us were like, what the hell? And he wore, like, really tight pants because it was 2012.
I kind of live for like teachers who do shit like that.
He was psycho. And he was, like, clearly going through a breakup. He was probably like 35. And was, like, really struggling.
Yeah, you can't go through a brick when you're a 35-year-old man. That's pretty much it for you at that point.
Yeah, it was crazy. Anyways, back to this.
So Atreus, Farron, they are the exact same. The way Atreus doted on Farron's mother over and over again and just was solely dedicated to her is the same way Farron treats Helena.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
But I also think that he was, in that way, he did a disservice to Farron. Because he was so focused on his mother that Farron didn't get enough from his dad. And I think that is what's beautiful about the ending of the book. Farron is so dedicated to it's hard for him, but he loves his child.
In a way, the array on his back, which creates, I don't want to say like a lack of consent in a way, but he doesn't have a choice in what he ends up being dedicated to once he's dedicated to it.
Yeah.
It helps him be a great father, actually, yeah.
But I think he also inherently wants to be, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so Atreus offers up his soul because when Ivy steals Maro's arm, which was a really sweet moment I actually really liked, where
I agreed.
Ivy's sister, Sophia, which was a corpse that Maro brought back, walks up and takes the arm. It leaves... The implication, because it's never fully delved into, that necromancy can keep a piece of the soul inside of it.
That's what I got from it, too.
Not fully, because Maro just also wasn't paying attention. There are two explanations each time. You know, same thing with the servants that I said earlier for Farron, and with Sophia's corpse as well, walks on up and grabs the arm. Sophia did it. She was able, which she shouldn't have been able to attack Maro.
Mm-hmm.
There's the logical explanation that Maro was so in such a weakened state, he really wasn't paying attention to what any of his necrothralls were doing.
Yeah.
And there's also the potential that Sophia was still somewhere very deep down in there.
I think that's what it is.
Doing something.
Yeah.
And I know I said this last time, but I really feel for Ivy.
Just I do too. She's
constantly trying to care for her sister who's a corpse.
It sucks.
Like that I said, sucks. It like just always walking around being, and she wanted so badly, she believed hard enough that her sister would come back to her and that everyone she betrayed and killed, it wouldn't have been for nothing.
I also have a sister named Sophia, so I relate.
Are you going to murder me and turn me into a necrothrall?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, fuck. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Worth a shot, guys. What? We're going to be doing episodes, and I'm just going to be here going.
Yep.
And it's going to be like, he's fine, guys. Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
So they're on the island with Lila. You meet Pol, named after his grandfather, Apollo.
Sweet.
Very adorable.
Mm-hmm. What's her kid's name?
Enid, after Farron's mother.
Yes.
Enid Rose Farron, which this
very cute.
Enid Rose Farron. Yes, yes, yes. And I couldn't help but think, like, we're not going to change that last name at all, guys.
I know. Let's be so
familiar. I guess that's just for the audience. Probably she has a different last name in, when she in goes the world. To the, yeah. The
Institute.
Sure Farron, that's like such name. A popular name. Yeah. Yeah. Enid Rose Bezos. What's going on?
Oh, my God.
Prolific, like, steel tycoon. Yeah, I've heard of them. Yeah.
That's so silly. It kind of gives, I think, so what I wanted to say, like, kind of like what I said earlier.
Yeah.
the way that they do actually get a happily ever after.
Yes.
Is so magical. I love the ending. It's basically the same as in Manacled, where she's at the institute and she finds the book about, because like, I understand they don't want to tell her that much about what happened. Like, she knows the kind of what happened.
I think she knows, quote unquote, the important thing.
Exactly. But also I understand them not wanting her to dwell in it and know too much, because like, she is such a, she is a product of such horrendous times,
yeah,
and the like the true trauma of her parents.
But she is the good from that horror that
exactly
came out of it.
And her talking to Paul and being like, do you think it's got it right, like, because it's the history of
the most
war.
In-depth one,
and she's like, yeah, okay, sure, you guys don't actually know shit.
Exact. But that's the point.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, the winner gets to decide what the story that they want to tell is. Mm-hmm. This is the story they want to tell. There is more to each story that, you know, we will never get to see in history. There's so much that we'll never really know about. We can just make guesses or estimations or trust sources that were given and passed down. But this war, like all the other ones before, like the one with Orion and the first necromancer,
right,
the two brothers, that no one's ever going to hear about that part of the story.
Yeah.
This is just another story that people will put down as something that happened without knowing what happened. That might have been, that got a little away from
me. No, I get what you're saying.
There,
I get what you're saying. It's beautiful because in a way they do get to put it behind themselves so hard.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, here's the quote. Everything people should know is in that book. And it does have everything that people should know. They should not know about Helena and Cain and all that, because Cain and Helena do not want them to know about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Exactly.
They want to live their lives separate. Maybe once they pass away, you could challenge the narrative and throw it out there if Lila's still around. I mean, like, hey, this is actually what happened.
Right.
But even Lila doesn't know the full story, because Helena and Cain are the same part of conveying a narrative where they don't say that Luke was possessed. Nobody is ever going to know that fact. Even Lila currently does not know the fact. Paul is never going to know that his father was being possessed by an evil necromancer when he was conceived.
And it's so for the best. And it's so, you're right, like, they are choosing that. But that, I think that's the magic of the ending of this, is on one hand, you're like, yes, but it's also so frustrating. You know, there's the famous last quote.
Yeah.
Can I read it?
Yes.
You know, there's the photo of
Soren, Luke, and Helena at the solstice celebration.
Wait, which way do you go? Oh, there we go. There they are. Wait, the lights. There we go. And it says, Principate Lucien hold fast with Paladin Soren by Bayard.
Bayard.
And foreign-born alchemist Helena Marino. All of a sudden, I don't know how to fucking read. Let me finish.
I'll take that from you, Helena Marino.
Marino left the city at the start of the Palladian Civil War to study healing. She survived the war but died during imprisonment prior to liberation. She was a non-active member of the Order of the Eternal Flame and did not fight. Ugh. It sucks so bad, because can you really think of anyone who fought more?
Exactly.
No, but.
And I think that's.
It's so magical because she, you know, like you said, she gets to move on from it in a way.
We are mad for her, but we don't have a right to be, if that makes sense, because she's getting what she wants. This idea, I think that's the conflicting feelings I have every time I read this.
Mm-hmm.
Even though knowing that would be how it ended, I was very confident those lines would be in the book.
Of course.
Because
it's the most
they're
iconic.
So spectacular. Yeah. When we first covered Manacled as our second episode ever that we ever made, I was freaking out about it. But in this story, you know, having time to really reflect on everything, we are angry because it's not fair and it's not just, but we don't have the right to be, in the sense that Helena and Cain do think it's fair and just. It is their choice to remain off to the sidelines, to not deal with it, to be aware and be happy with each other, because they get their happily ever after. They do. They live in a village in peace for the rest of their lives, raising their child.
No one's bothering them.
No one bothers them.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that Etrus, it's an island in Etrus, because there are a lot of islands.
Sorry.
Once again, Etrus is Greece, guys. You tell me I got to go live on a Greek island for the rest of my days in peace and harmony.
Mm-hmm. It's a life they never thought there was a moment that was impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so much, they spent so many years thinking that they would never get to have the happiness that they end up to happiness. They're still traumatized and living with that, but they get to put it behind them and they get to live with these kids.
Exactly. But they only thought they didn't get to have that because they weren't actively fighting for it ever.
Yeah.
And it's only when they dedicate, because they run out of every other option,
yeah,
that they can fight for themselves to live together happily. So when Enid goes to that store there and she sees the book and it's not fair and people should know, Enid confesses, you know, every time I've asked them about things, you know, my mom has her heart issues and my dad is worried that I'll never look at him the same again because he did do bad things. But I think, especially with how loving parents they are, and I know some people might like feel certain ways about this, especially when it comes to parents and everyone's situation is unique. When your parents are like that loving towards you or something like that, despite what they've done in their lives, as you grow up, you know, you learn that your parents are humans too.
Yeah. When
you're a kid, people, they're just like, whoa, they got everything figured out. And as you get older, you realize mistakes have been made in their lives. They're not always great people here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But at, depending on how they've raised you, essentially, if they were present and there and cared about you, no matter what they do, really, you're kind of always going to have some amount of love or feelings towards them.
For the most part.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know, I know there is. That's why I said, like, it's very clear about, like, how they raise you. It's, if Cain said everything that he did, I don't think Enid would ever reject him.
Yeah.
Is the thing, because she has the full context of everything. He is afraid of that. Oh. And she's read about what he's done, the way the world talks about him.
Yeah.
But the motivations are always wrong. Going back to what I said earlier, that nobody's finding out the root cause. They have suspicions about why he did what he did. Oh, he wanted power and he was money. Mm-hmm. Why was he, though? Let's find out the deepness.
Right.
And just once again, Cain, Helena, they have their happy ending and it's enough for them.
Mm-hmm.
So the conflicting feelings that I have as a reader, you probably feel this too, is that,
mm-hmm.
but it's not fair for me that you don't get the recognition you deserve.
But it's also not about us.
It's not about us, though.
It's about them.
So I think that's the beauty of this ending here is all the catharsis of emotions that they are happy, but it's not just. But it is just because it's what they want. This is the perfect outcome for them. It's just... And it's honestly, it's the perfect outcome for the reader, too, because they get to live happily.
Yeah.
But we're sitting there going, but it's not fair. They won. They should get to decide how the story ends. Mm-hmm. They do decide how it ends.
No,
they decide
right.
This is the narrative that's going to be pushed. We are out of it. Ah!
Zenlin, you're the smartest person to ever exist.
You are the youngest person ever.
It's just... Like I said, I don't know if anything's ever made me feel this way.
Yeah.
The way you just explained that was so eloquent.
I've been stewing about it for like a week about exactly what I want to say. And I still don't think I fully said it the way I wanted to, but I think it was good enough.
I think you did a great job. It's just the way, like at the end of the day, like all of these, we read books to make us feel these things. Mm-hmm. And I think all that an author could, I'm not an author. But in my opinion, as someone who appreciates art, all that an author really, all that matters to them is the way that it makes us feel. You know, that is the goal. It's to make us feel something and to, you know, to bring these ideas forward and to have it, to clearly execute this. And I hope that they understand that
impactful the story
is. I'm sure that's kind of the goal going into this, and I feel like rarely has it been done so effectively as mm-hmm. it is here.
Yeah. Suddenly you. I didn't walk into this intending to fully glaze every aspect of it, but well done.
It's unbelievable. It really is. I just want to read a few quotes really quick, and then we'll be
your top out quotes. Of here. Absolutely.
Okay, here's one.
We're stopping at three parts, guys. We did it.
Here's one. We'll be out of here really quick. I didn't write down when they were from, so sorry.
I'll know.
Being alive is not the same as living. I hope someday you'll have a chance to realize the difference.
That's the other healer that's in the institute with her. What's her name?
I don't remember.
She cracks her neck, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, where's the other one? He'd loved her even though he never expected them to be anything but doomed. He'd love her all the same. If he's a monster, then I'm his creator. Bars. Hey, bars. You made me feel like the parts of me that aren't useful still deserve to exist. Like I'm not just all the things I can do.
Absolutely.
Damn. They were the inverse and counter to each other. A healer and killer. Circling slowly, the push and pull The push and pull inexorable.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Those are about. Oh, this is kind of a long one. Oh, Moreno. His thumb trailed along her neck, following the scar below her jaw. If I'd known what pain you'd caused me, I never would have taken you. He sighed, and she could smell the liquor on his breath as his head dipped closer. She had no idea what he meant, if she was supposed to apologize. But at this point, I suppose I deserve to burn. I wonder if you'll burn too.
Ugh, so
good. Like, it's so good. Those are some of my favorites.
All the dialogue, all the names of everyone, it all just so cohesively goes together. And
I think she says this to him, or he says this, you'll do anything for the people who'll let you love them.
Ugh. That's Cain saying it to her. Yeah.
It's just so good. Farron always comes for me. Period.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not a romantic way, Solomon.
And not in a
romantic way.
He always shows up for her. Damn.
Yeah.
You've been listening to his talk for far too many years.
Yeah, we've done too many other weird books.
I know. That wasn't a romance.
He's like so confused. He's like, wow, is this that good of a book? Like, usually we're just sitting there being like, so he sticks a knife into the bed and then.
We've never sounded smarter.
Yeah. And with that.
That's it, you guys.
Thank you for staying along with us. We'll be having something new. We may have something very interesting in the works right now. If you guys are fans of Minotaurs by chance.
Perhaps.
Who can say?
Well,
on a text back.
Alexandros, you did a good job.
We did it. Wait, should we?
Hi, Ten. That's for you, Mr.
Cost. Thank you
Cost.
For tuning on in for all three parts. One extra part than we intended. But I've had so much fun talking about this. I could talk about it for another 10 episodes probably.
And I'm sure you will at some point.
And we hope you enjoyed it as well.
Yay! Let us know your thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you for sticking on by. As always, like, comment, subscribe.
Live, laugh, and love.
And thank you guys for being here. Okay?
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.